something stupid, then you just say, oh, I actually cut that out. Yeah, when I took it back, I cut it out.
I tend to waffle, mate. So it could be interesting.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Wombat Radio. Matt, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. My name's Matthew McVeigh. I'm a artist that was born in Western Australia. I have a background in theatre design, so scenography, car setting, costume. And I've been working mainly locally, but I have done some stuff over east in that area. But I very early on in my career kind of went into community arts and sculpture and public art and started doing my own practice as a way of sort of subsidising the theatre work because I wasn't getting a heap of work. And so I sort of now I've got this really diverse interdisciplinary practice.
And it sounds like interdisciplinary, intermedium, interprofessional versus amateur versus community. It sounds very actually inter. All of it is inter.
Yeah. Inter. Yeah. It's that funny one in the arts is defining what you do. And I think if you look at it across Australia, I suppose I would call myself an interdisciplinary artist.
Yeah. Can you talk to a little bit about the power of scenography as a medium?
Yeah. So how I explain set design is set design really in the word is a setting. So it's creating a setting or a place for a performance, where scenography really sort of goes into the physiology or the atmosphere of a space. It kind of talks about space a lot more than maybe what a set design would. It's really having a physiological effect on the audience or playing with the idea of emotional or more of a mental reading of what's happening on stage. It's a bit more abstract. You can have settings, but it's more about the emotional response or the atmosphere of that space. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the settings become the tool to achieve the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Maybe we'll just let this tractor go past. So can you tell me about how you work out what scenography, something that you're working on needs, whether it's a play or a dance piece or a film or a performance, or how do you know what it needs?
That's a really hard question, man. What it needs. It's not what it really needs, it's what it wants. Like sometimes when you're sort of working on a script, it can be even like the technical side of things. You're trying to work out something, and like say take puppetry, there might be this sort of really interesting idea that comes about through like a creative development process that you kind of go, how are we going to technically achieve that? And then you sort of build the rest of it around that. Maybe one scene that has happened before. I did do a production. I think the first time I ever... Oh, no, it wasn't the first time, but I mean, one of the most successful stage designs I did where I would say it was scenography was a production of Cloud Street. And obviously, it jumps across many locations, from interior to exterior spaces. You're near water to desert to a house. Like, there's hundreds of different scenes. And to achieve that technically in the space we had, we didn't have the technology, like we didn't have fly lines or things to be literal about that. So the director and I just sort of were vibing about sort of looking at a lot of the big settings where the whole family were there, and it was all a lot about being outside and about she wanted to really look at that. And I started to look at a lot of just pictures of trees and sand and clouds and environments, and I ended up creating this stage which was sort of a rake that curved up, so it was like it looked like a sand dune with no horizon. It had built up texture that if you lit it from the bottom, it looked like it would pop out, so it would sort of look like sand ripples. Mm-hmm. But if you had moving light over it, it became like water ripples. And all of a sudden, this stage had a transform. It just transformed from different location very simply through the relationship of light on surface. And you know, when people were sitting on up on the rake and kind of moving into the curve of the rake, it really looked like a sand dune. And it was light lit really warm. And then we backlit the whole rake and put holes in the front. So when they were standing on it, they would be, there was a star cairn behind them that the whole stage would disappear into blackness, but they were elevated in the space and all these stars would appear. So, you know, all of a sudden they were actually physically in the sky. And when that was lit blue with a bit of a mover and they were in the, on the top of the rake again on a boat, it was water. And it was about, that was sonography to me, because it was about the relationship of a person to really sculptural forms. And, and it used that space, it really relied on the audience to, because we were setting it in WA and a lot of the audience were West Australian, it was like, well, you know, to literally represent Cottesloe, you're going to fail. So you just give a hint at it and you'd rely on the audience to fill in all the blanks. Yeah, like for example, the shops were only crates, and the only thing we had on stage to represent the interior of the house was an old piano, which a couple of ghost figures would surround, and you'd have a couple of everything that you put on stage therefore became really important. So like the little tin bath, the kitchen table wheeled on, like all those sort of, I suppose, props really helped with the setting, but they were in this bigger space all the time. So that's my explanation of sonography.
It's concise. I wonder how working outside of an urban setting and up in the Pilbara, and like you'd go there to do different kinds of work, but then it affects you as well. So I wonder if you could talk about the exciting parts of that kind of work and then how it affects how you view things when you're back in a black box theatre and inventing those worlds.
Well, anyone who's been up to the Pilbara will just go, just the way that light works up in the Pilbara is it's phenomenal. Like, I remember the first time I went up there, and my favourite Australian, probably, painter is Fred Williams, and he did this whole Pilbara series, and I remember when I was just got out of the, I think it was Karratha, and we moved up the coast towards Roebourne, and I was just looking at a lot of the forms and was just like, oh, there's Fred Williams, you know. And how I sort of explain to people is it's all complementary colours. So it's just this palette of orange and red against this vibrant blue of the sky, and they're pure complementary colours. And you'll go to these pockets of just vibrant colours, you know, like when you go into Karajini, it's just this scar in the landscape that has all this ecology, and it's wet. It's like a different ecological system, really. I'm not sure if that would kind of become that would be considered rainforest, actually.
Yeah, I don't know what we term it, but definitely I feel the difference as well. You feel a drop in temperature even.
Yeah, it's a sort of
skin.
Yeah, and I found I don't know, man. It just feels real. You really... Like, when I went up there, I was like, oh, man, I don't know what this spirituality to land is. You know, I've never felt that anywhere else. But when I went up there, I definitely had moments where I was in awe of its beauty. And, you're just going, oh, man, I can see how there's this animism or spirituality that someone could have looking at this landscape.
I have a similar experience whenever I get to go to the Kimberleys.
Yeah.
And it's almost, I don't know how to describe it in any framework that I already understand, but it's humbling.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
The idea of a person owning land becomes ridiculous in my mind.
Yeah.
And I start to get closer to what I guess the belief is that the land that you are of the land, that the land is what is owning you and providing for you, and that to consider the other way around is ludicrous.
Yeah, no, it's a symbiotic relationship, you know. It's that's sort of when I sort of said land is Aboriginality, like it's they're not distinct. It's not a human being and land have a symbiotic relationship. They one provides to the other. You become a custodian, not an owner. It's 100%, man. Mm. Yeah.
Do you want to just describe a little bit the stuff that you're doing up there?
Yeah. So I suppose it's the first time I went up there. I was maybe like 20, and that was on a project in Roeburn, which we actually never got to stage, but it was a literacy-based project looking at sort of history, sort of not traditional storytelling, but like looking at what had happened the last 30 years in Roeburn, looking at kind of the shift from asbestos mining and the impact the industry had on Roeburn. And Roeburn's a funny place now because it's still in this massive mining capital of WA, but it's this little town in between a port and Karratha, Point Sampson, and up towards that area and Wickenham. There's a massive port up there, but it's sort of this forgotten little town. It's a hard place. There's a lot of poverty. I found there's a lot of divide between different Aboriginal corporations, and I feel that idea of capitalism and ownership has really torn a lot of families apart. But at the same time, I found the artists actually were leading the way. Like with the Roeburn Art Group, there was a lot of quite matriarchal, I don't know if it was traditionally with that skin group or language group up there, but it felt very matriarchal when I was up there. And some of the ladies that painted just were holding, for me, about six of them were holding the community together. And that's what the project was really about, was about trying to create that opportunity just to facilitate, give them some framework for the elders to facilitate them in passing down a bit of history to the kids. And it was really hard because different Aboriginal corporations got involved, everyone had a different kind of idea of how an agenda and outcome, and it was really frustrating, man, because I just really wanted to see, I could see the value in the project in its idealistic form, like it's just about passing down stories, but everyone had a different trajectory.
When you talk about facilitating frameworks for them, and as you were talking before about it, symbiotic, it's give and take, I wonder about the ways that the things they were facilitating for you to discover or see or understand.
Time's the idea of time is a very different relationship up in the Pilbara. Everyone I went to the Kimberley too, there's this across the north, call it Broome time or Yarru time or, you know, Pilbara time. Time doesn't have the same relationship that maybe it does in the cities. It's really about space and discussing things, and I had to be very patient.
You had to learn how to be that other time.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Which at the beginning feels like patience, and then as you're getting into it feels like a kind of ignorance.
Yeah.
Somehow. Like I thought I knew.
Yeah.
The way, the time.
Yeah.
But I'm still learning.
Yeah.
I wonder about the man heaviness of these regions and what your experience of that was.
Yeah, well, I lived in Tom Price for 3 months on a air grant, so that was something that I did.
Through Tom Price.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting place because there was there was a lot of people that were like living in Tom Price as well as FIFO. So you really had two different lifestyles within the mining sector to compare. And I was working a lot at the schools, and I found it was still a very male-orientated industry. Like, the men were still the majority of employees. And so I suppose the kids really craved that older male relationship. And so, I'd be – the kids would ask me to play basketball and football with them, and we'd have talks. And, a lot of them would just innocently start to talk about family stuff, about how, they didn't see Dad much, or, Dad was too tired to do things. And it seemed like affection was replaced with commodity. Like, everyone had a plasma TV. You go in Tom Price and there'd be plasma TVs blaring out the window. And all these kids had been very well travelled. They'd gone on trips to Europe and all that. A lot of them get sent down to boarding school. But they didn't seem to have that really strong time with Dad. And the sporting clubs were absolutely pumping. Like, everyone really got into sports because I think that camaraderie with older males. It was a very male-orientated community, actually.
Mm. And do you think that that's just normal for the men who are working to not have that kind of time or energy left over, or not push back at a work schedule because they need to be with their children or something, that's just what they assume is the way that things are done?
Well, I think it's just a system that's in place. Like, yeah. I think if you talk to most of the miners, from a social point of view, it's high income, but the working environment sucks. I haven't really met a miner that's gone, I love working 14-hour days, and the two-in-one. You lose 2 days when you're 1 week off travelling sometimes. So, but it was quite interesting, the idea of female too. It's like they were very masculine as well. Like, I don't know, it was a very... It was all about sort of turnover. I found that about... Like, there were... Yeah, it was I don't know how to really describe it. It was a funny... it's very different to anywhere I'd been. I suppose that was... I'd been travelled into Karratha and Wickenham and all that up north, but only for a couple of weeks at a time, whereas this I felt after 3 months, and I've been up there a couple of times since. Like, I lived with a family, for example. I really kind of started to understand this, the politics, and there was a lot of gossip you'd hear about and how that small town operated. Yeah.
And is there anything that you really notice has stuck with you from that, now that you're back in your studio in Maitlands and working on stuff?
I found all the people that were sort of the teachers. So I worked with teachers as well, and they lived up in the Pilbara, and they'd sort of go away, and they were quite happy. Like, I suppose I don't know that I was in town, so part of them, I think they were quite excited to revisit sites and take me out and all that. I've done the same thing when I've met backpackers. You take them up to Kings Park and you feel guilty because you haven't been up there for a year, but this person hasn't been, so you kind of rediscover it through their eyes. It made me really think about, I suppose, capitalism and how that really affects your idea of environment and land. I feel like man right now is really about manipulating its environment for its own means, whereas...
Conquering.
It's like you own it. It's mine, And that was one thing that I discovered in a lot of Indigenous dialect. There isn't this yours or mine. That was this word doesn't really exist. It's a paradigm
of the rest of the other cultures, you know, around, like, ownership wasn't really something I came across. It's something that I do believe does exist now, and I think that's because of capitalism. Yeah.
Maybe we can talk about your vision for now future things, like the project that you were talking about before with the four boys and...
Yeah, it's not really my project. It's my mate Jacob Leary's. He's a dancer that I met in Perth. He's originally from Canberra and lived in Victoria, now resides in Perth with his family. He wrote this grant for four of us. So Jacob is a Jewish man. I was sort of raised as a Catholic. We're not religious, but this is just what our backgrounds. My mate Kyle Morrison, who is the artistic director of Yiri Yarkin, I suppose he's Noongar, and I think he might be Manjima, I'm not sure, but he's definitely Noongar. And this other guy, David, who partners with Jacob a lot in improvisation, they're two sort of males that dance together. He really wasn't brought up with any religion, and I suppose we're going to Israel with the Holy Land and looking back retrospectively at nationalism within Australia and the idea of being male and manhood, and obviously within religious frameworks Jacob and me, for example, have been, in the eyes of our religious rituals, man, but I don't feel like I'm a man yet. I question whether Jacob's a man. He might say he is, but I question that. Looking at the idea of using dance and as a way of looking at that, and also touching into others' culture. We were sort of, if you're going to start to look at cultural referencing and appropriation and that tension between that, I think dance is probably the most interesting one, because dance is referenced all the time cross-culturally, whereas if you start to talk about in visual arts, you know, especially the non-Indigenous and Indigenous tension between appropriation. I don't know. It will be an interesting project. It's in its very early development. So,
The thing that I'm thinking about at the moment with the Blokes project, which sounds like it's concerned with very similar things, which is that this is the story we've been fed about what it is, whether it's from religion or capitalism or colonialism or even just family structure. And that story doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah, I agree.
And so it's a result. It's some kind of, it's a tension and a lack of resolve between cultural heritage, but now identity, cultural identity as an individual. And a little bit wondering, well, maybe there's a lot of shit around the thing that isn't the thing. So, like the classic, do you want a car to get you from A to B, or do you want one that's got LEDs and a blow-off valve and shit? It's like there are different priorities for different things, but both will do the thing, but one's going to cost you a lot more and cost the environment a lot more and put you in greater danger and cost other people around you much more with speed and sound pollution and shit like that. And it feels kind of like that with whatever is the idea of masculinity and how to perform it, that hopefully it's based on much more noble ideals of authenticity, of personal responsibility, and that somehow has been amped up and then redirected towards a brute stoicism that somehow means that you need to defend your position, so be immovable, and then cannibalize all the different influences that come close to you so that you don't adapt or yeah. grow or change.
Well, even in the discussions, the four of us, like, we're all kind of, Kyle and me are probably, I'm the youngest, but Kyle's about 5 years older than me, and then Jacob's in his 40s, and David's in his 40s, and they've got kids. So, you know, even the idea of having children, that's a different, that's a consideration of manhood, because there's responsibility, but we're all coming from it from very different backgrounds, and that idea of masculinity becomes very, it's a bizarre kind of conversation to have, because you think you kind of understand it until you really start to look into it. And I agree with what you're saying. And for example, like for a lot of, when I went up north, I found even in Roebourne, there was this sort of like, you did your, to be a man, you kind of did time in jail. That was a funny thing, you know, like there was, I'd sort of go, oh, where's, you know, where's Bill or where's that fella? And they'll be like, oh, he's hanging out with a mob in jail, mate. He's just doing a year. And it was this, it was like, oh, it was very casual. Like it wasn't like if I went to jail between my friends, it would be, it'd be a big deal. But I suppose up there, it's such a common thing. And you, and
it's like a rite of passage.
Yeah, rite of passage. And a lot of these guys are just going to jail because they've had a couple of tinnies and got behind the wheel. And they've been told off that many times that the cops are just going, well, that's it. You're doing some time. And I suppose it's the sad thing is a lot of the time going to jail is actually reconnecting with family, which people don't think about, you know, until you're up there. And that's a completely different cultural framework. Is it a cultural framework, or is it just the privilege of being non-Indigenous, you know, like in Australia, like and also environment? All that plays into it, and it becomes a very diverse conversation, masculinity, when you start to look at where you're coming from with that question.
Yeah, I even wonder about the that it's been hijacked to push nationalism.
And I hate the Reclaim Australia movement, man. There's one thing I absolutely hate. We kind of were laughing about between our mates. We were like, we need to create a party that's called the Reframe Movement, which is about reframing the idea of what nationalism is. I've been sort of doing that in my own art practice, actually. I've been sort of playing with Eureka flags and a lot of working uniforms and referencing this idea of unionism, which we've been built on. But the idea of unions even have become very different things with the CFMEU today. Because unionism's back with the Eureka thing was about justice for the people and, like, you know, working conditions where people weren't dying, and now it's sort of about putting money in your pocket. Like, it's a, yeah, it's a, and the Reclaim Australia thing is just so, so toxic, like.
And built on ignorance.
Oh, so ignorant, like, yeah, so ignorant.
And it's the unfortunate thing that the people who are not conflicted are the ones that, like, it's easier to be not conflicted if you don't know very much.
Yes, yeah. And that's the thing is, I your frustration can turn into anger, and I suppose that's where I've been very careful, because I can
get righteous.
Yeah, I can. I can get on my high horse, man. I can rant, that's for sure, and I can ear bash people. I don't tend to swing my arms very often. I don't get violent, I suppose physically violent, but I can get very aggressive. And I have to remember that, you know, I've been very lucky that I've had those opportunities to sort of see how other Australians or people living in Australia live. And I've had a lot of exposure to different cultures even when I was growing up as a kid. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I don't think I had a male friend until I was about six, because it's all little girls that were hanging out around my suburbs, so my friends were girls. And then I went to an all-boys school. And then I went to Wapare, which, you know, being a guy who liked football and was straight, that was very different for Wapa. So you got, there's this tribalism, and people tend to hang out in their own packs and people that reinforce their own views, whereas I have to be honest, I've got some friends that I really strongly disagree with what they think and say, but I've known them for a long time, and there's that loyalty. And,
and they're still good people.
Yeah, at the rest. Yeah,
and
they
that's
are.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
That's the hard thing, is that Yeah, opinions do not make the person, but somehow they drive action.
Yes, 100%.
And then we all have to share the same world that those actions are taking place.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about the nationalism stuff that you've been doing and how you've been pushing against that or making fun of it or rewriting that narrative?
Yeah. My first ever solo exhibition was called Mine. And it was basically in response to all the time I'd spent in the Pilbara and coming in and out of, you know, Perth and going back up north, coming back into Perth and north and listening to what the media had said and, you know, talking to a miner who was so worried about his small community because Fortescue had fallen in prices and that was going to even affect the bakery. And you could see the real... You saw it, the money, even got sitting there and seeing the trains go off into the distance and they would be like, that's $20 million. The sheer size of it became tactile and you read about it from a foreign point of view, like, oh yeah, it's a massive industry that's underpinning our economy. But when you actually see it physically, how it operates, it's just, you just go, it just, even as a little kid, if you think like, so you have these major... production of taking iron ore out, sending it over to China, buying the steel back, it seems ludicrous. Like, it really does seem crazy, but it's because of, you know, wages over in China compared to here. And it gets really quite diverse. So I suppose industry was really something I was interested in, how that shaped identity. Because the more you look into West Australian history... is we are very labour-based, you know, we live in a boom and bust environment, which has been on agriculture and mining. You know, we had gold rush here and we've had a number of sort of booms in the ore industry, a bit of petroleum. And I suppose industry, that sort of dirty industry attracts males. And males start to get a higher income and, you know, have a bit of, I suppose that industry's been a real influence on how things are regulated and politically and all that. So that was sort of mine, and also the contentious issue between ownership, between industry and I suppose traditional custodians. And so that led me to look at Built, which was a recent exhibition looking at my own sort of narrative within West Australia, but looking really at cities. And how I sort of structure my exhibitions is you take this metaphor, like mine, I kind of looked into community, social transient communities, economics, ritual. So all the stuff in Built was mine was... made from the land, so all the paper was made from spinifex. I used ochre that I was given from the indigenous community. I'd use asbestos and ore, and all the sculptures were made from shut mines that were shut down. And Built was sort of really looking at materials that were used in construction, looking at stories in my own life, and trying to expand from this idea of what is built, you know. So I sort of took myself on as an architect or an urban planner and built this team around it. And part of the process of that is trying to really look at what it really means to make collaborative artwork. And I suppose it was art, if you wanted to get really technical, it was art that I made within community and took it into a commercial framework. But I worked with a lot of non-artists, which were males. You know, part of the process was bringing my own politics and views into their profession and the technical things of their profession into mine. And we've all become quite close. Like the engineers I work with, for example, we're going to hang out and they've made an electrical three-wheel motorcycle and we're gonna have a spin on it. And Ken, who was the
the main engineer. It's a father and son team. He's a bit of a closet artist. He made a few kinetic wind sculptures, and you discover all these things that, you know, through the vehicle of art, we found commonality, and that's what I'm really interested. I'm really interested in art as a vehicle of redefining all those things, and that there's no, it's not competition. It's, you know, that's what I do like about it. I don't even know if I've answered your question, man, to be
honest.
No,
but it's interesting to come, like, to think about nationalism and then to take the step towards industry-based self-identity,
yeah,
and employment-based self-identity, and that if all of your employment is industry and industry is working from the idea of conquering and ownership, yeah, and manipulation for greater comfort or prosperity as we know it, and then to meet the people, the individuals who are the face of that definition or,
yeah,
other, and be affected by them, and hopefully then, as you exactly said, affect them because you are now individuals who are sharing a space and a time, and you realize that they live 24 hours a day and they might work 10 hours a day, but they still have a couple of hours outside of sleeping where they make kinetic sculptures or,
yeah,
where they invent, you know, motorcycle walls to ride around, and it's their hobby, and they are building things from their imagination and ingenuity, and,
yeah,
and that their job is something that they do.
Yeah.
And it's not who they are.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to forget. And I really enjoy the idea that art has replaced religion or consumerism as a way to meet people outside of their job that they have to have.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was even interesting, like, working with a lot of engineers, like, they're running small business, like I run a small business too, you know, mine's just an art-based business, whereas theirs engineering, but there was definitely a crossover. You know, we were both, that was an innovation to what we both did. We were trying to redefine what we did, and these guys that I worked with, for example, were, they used to patent pistons, and they can't compete with the Chinese market. So they've had to look more broadly to survive. And the next leg of the work is actually to go to China and look back retrospectively at the exhibition Built in Mind. And how I explain it to people is I'm sort of following this idea of songlines, which I came across, but within my own cultural framework. And I suppose I make art that references the idea of Aboriginality. Like a lot of my work's about mapping and heterotopian space, which is about mental and physical space existing in the same plane, which to me is similar to, maybe has sort of a similar kind of paradigm to maybe like a word in Yaru language like Lian, where everything's all encompassing, you know. So like in, you know, when I look at a tree, I might see, you know, just a tree, there's a whole ecology system. And what I find really fascinating is someone in the indigenous community might go, well, that's where my placenta was buried, and that's me, you know, and trying to work all that out, but using my capitalist framework and industry and all that, and having, because that's where I've come from. I'm a non-indigenous dude that has worked. Majority of my career has been working with indigenous communities, and that feeds into my work. And it's about trying to explore the concept rather than an aesthetic or a style, or even appropriation. I'm not interested in that, but I'm interested in the acknowledgement or the reference of that in my work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It seems like, how else can I know this thing,
yeah,
beyond the framework that has been handed to me or forced upon me?
Yeah.
I was talking to a guy based in Melbourne called Leuli, and he is working very heavily, almost similar to what you're talking about, songlines.
Yeah.
That's a cultural framework to understand something, and we have cultural frameworks to understand something. And he was talking very much about being Islander versus and but being French because some of the islands are colonized and still run with this French acculturation.
Yeah.
And but then being from his bloodline, Persian.
Yeah.
But then what is the idea of the Pacific Islands as one thing because they're all different things? And how did the Philippines become a single nation when they're actually many, many different people? And and I asked him the thing that I still haven't worked out, which is I see the value and importance and significance of an indigenous relationship to somewhere for all peoples of the world.
Yes, and, I agree.
And how can I, with great respect and care and without insult, how can I consider my own indigeneity as an individual? How can I place myself as being owned by a certain land or being a custodian of a certain land?
Yeah.
And because I don't consider myself anything that my blood has come from, but then I also am pushing back really heavily around whatever is the Australian identity that is the term that's on my passport. So the idea that we, and Leula's like, well, we're all indigenous to somewhere. And if that somewhere is Earth, well, maybe we're breaking it down into small things that change over time. And
Well, that's been the contentious issue between exclusivity and inclusivity.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we're really at the moment. And I think we're a highly globalized network in terms of economic system, but socially we're not still.
Yeah, money can flow, information can flow, but people, they have to stay where they are. And there's big barbed wire fences to make sure that happens.
Yeah, and there's segregation everywhere. Like, and it's in all cultures, it's a human thing to run in your own pack, you know, people that you see similarities, and it reinforces who you are. I'm interested in that idea, but also trying to break that idea as well. You know, where we see, you know, I think the biggest problem with Australia at the moment is sub-consuming and consuming all sides of history. I think we've, you know, my mum's an ESL teacher and it's incredible, the curriculum now. She's teaching Australian history, but a lot of it's looking at prior to colonization and it's really great. Looking at even stories from all around the Southern Hemisphere about the Southern Cross, you know, which has become this thing that's owned by white supremacy. That's what it's become now.
But it's such beautiful poetry, isn't it?
Yeah, it's such a, to me, when I see the Southern Cross, I'm like, where you pricks, that's mine. And I don't, it isn't about suppression or oppression of one racial group. Like it's we're all under one sky, you know. And it's, I think it's really, really important to for people to realize that this, you know, it's okay to be proud of the Southern, you know, like a symbolism or nationalism, as long as it's not oppression of another group. So it's about that. Yeah, I quite like using symbol. I've even been quite fascinated with the Nazi symbol.
The town hall down near Circular Quay in Sydney, there's a Nazi symbol in the floor because it was a Tibetan symbol.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was
flipped.
Flipped. It's a beautiful thing. Even, I think, hang on, I'm heterosexual and I respect and appreciate but can't speak from a point of authority about any other feeling of intersex or queer culture or anything like that, but I don't want the rainbow taken away from me.
I am exactly the same, man. The rainbow is a very fascinating thing because it's actually it's in a lot of different religious cultures. Like it's a covenant in if you read
To Noah.
Yeah, to Noah. And the Norwegians and Vikings, like, had a very similar idea of a rainbow. Like, these ideas of astrology and stars and, you know, all religion at some point, I think, stems from astrology in some... There's a lot of stories that, you know...
Yeah. Imagine if it was, like, the Southern Cross and everybody got the idea, okay, we need to meet under the Southern Cross to be with our tribe and our people and can reinforce our ideas. And so all the white supremacists met under the Southern Cross, and all of the indigenous groups that have their stories
even
met
Muslim
under it.
People that say they're Australian, it's like ridiculous. Yeah. Like they, yeah, I find that a really fascinating one too. You know, we and the thing is, we're not that multicultural. That's the kind of thing that we've told ourselves that we are multicultural. But in terms of globally, we actually have a very small percentage.
Yeah, right. It's a weird thing, isn't it? Because the hope is, yeah, the hope is that we all meet under that Southern Cross that we think is us and nobody else, and then we realize that it's everybody, and then we're all the same tribe.
Yeah, and there's other places in the Southern Hemisphere that have stories about the Southern Cross. It's not, it's not like we own that bit of sky under our land. Like, no. It's, yeah.
No. But yeah, it's an interesting thing that there's just so much to know.
Yeah.
And so often you get retold the same one way or one story through your entire building of self-identity as a child and into adulthood, and that keeps getting reinforced, and nobody ever says, well, you know, those camels that are in Australia, they came with people from the Middle East who were specialist at surviving in the desert, and they kept alive a lot of the white settlers that came with them.
Yeah.
And so it isn't a sudden thing
It's
to have these people in our culture. Like Australian culture has words in it that we've forgotten their lineage. Yeah. Pajamas.
Pajamas.
Pajamas is an Indian word.
Is it really? Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really interested in, there's a guy called, I think his name's Peter Dwartz. He's been, he's an artist who's been, real Australians say welcome. He's been doing all these posts.
So I'm driving along in a car that I was rebuilding with my dad. So rebuilding a 67 Mustang in a shed, father-son bonding time. And then I'm driving into the city in Darwin, and my 8-year-old nephew is in the passenger seat, or maybe he's 10, like very young, and reads that sign and asks me what it means.
Yeah.
And I thought, that artist is a genius.
Yeah.
Because he's just like taking that tribal catch cry, real Australians, and it's like, all right, if you want to be a real Australian, you've got to be a better person.
Yeah.
Real Australian. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, well, and just explaining to him in a way that was like, well, some people think this way and some people think that way, but if we were in this circumstance, we would hope that other people would treat us differently than we're treating them.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And I suppose that's the thing, is the colonial myth is when we came on boats over here, we were actually welcomed by a lot of indigenous communities because they saw us as ancestral spirits. That's like the white skin. If you go up into the caves, a lot of the Wajuna, for example, is painted with white ochres. And I believe there was a lot of trade between Australian land, so indigenous groups with the Chinese. But I think there was heaps of the Chinese and the Dutch, then we all know they came here, but they didn't colonize the country. Whereas when we came over, we occupied the land, and I think through their own frameworks and stories, they believe we were ancestral spirits. And history is being told from the conquerors, and how I sort of see, I don't feel guilty at all, man, because I was born here, and I people get very funny about saying that. I don't feel guilty about what happened. If I was, I'd be guilty about the whole global system, you know?
And guilt doesn't really help.
No, but I'm angry that we haven't got to a place of acknowledgement, and that's, I do see a lot of my friends who struggle with their identities,
as men and then as Australians,
and as
adults.
Yeah, as also, you know, indigenous to here, but also having very diverse other cultures that it's quite fascinating that a lot of, a lot of indigenous people that see themselves as indigenous really talk about that skin group or language group, but they've also made up of many other diverse groups as well. And there is this, some of them are, even within their own, with their indigenous friends, they might be too white or
too educated, or, you know, it's a really hard one. And I think until Australia really go, fuck, man, a lot of these guys are displaced. They're victims of war. They lost. They haven't been recognised as victims of war. You know, we need to be really transparent about where massacre sites were. Like, for example, there's Rottnest, for example, Pinjarra, you know, where Kimberley, mate, like heaps. You know,
maybe that's something else that we can, that will, like, before when okay, we thought this person was this thing, but then we discovered we shared innovation practice or art practice or something. I think displacement is a really common
across the world, actually.
Across so many people who are in Australia, whether they were born here or not, they were a lot of them didn't come by choice.
Yeah,
and a lot of them weren't, and none of them were invaded by choice.
Yeah. And I suppose it's hard because I'm coming from, like, I don't really have a, I know I've got Spanish heritage, Irish and Scottish. Yeah, like,
that's not your identity.
No,
either.
It's not at all. But these are things that are my genetic lines. I'm not connected to any of that. But I suppose because of what's happened with, you know, a lot of minority groups hold on to that because that's an identity which they've lost. Yeah. And one thing I always look at, even say take African-American culture, is holding on to those African roots. But like things like hip-hop and, hip-hop culture. I did a course about religion and hip-hop actually over in the US. And that has obviously come from the roots of it, from Black America. But that's because of American culture too feeding into it. And there's a beauty it's terrible, the past, you know. But we should also embrace what are the positives. And I don't think we're having enough of that conversation. Mm. You know, like, for example, with the contemporary Indigenous art movement, you know, Grayson Perry, just recently, who I absolutely love from England, he kind of made a comment about Indigenous art being displayed as contemporary art. And people, he's saying he thought it was more like a minimalist or abstraction, and he kind of was like, well, should it be kind of put in as anthropological reading? And yeah, he got in a lot of issue about it. But I, one of the things that I, when I, well, I sort of like looking into the kind of commercial Indigenous art of the 70s, 80s, 90s, is even the dot painting that came about from stations where, I believe it was they were using dots to disguise mappings that they had done, and a priest or something, I think it was, like, oh, why don't we do that kind of style of art? And that became a movement, and that's it's dot painting has become Aboriginal, but I think it's about, it's a fusion of Australian and Aboriginal culture, actually. And you don't want to take that away because it's an incredibly beautiful art form, but there is this sense of ownership over it, and that's fine. But I think as long as we kind of realise that to be where we are right now, and I suppose that's what a lot of the urban Aboriginal art movement's talking about, actually. I find that all really fascinating. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going with it, but
And I also, if we're going back to symbols and the power of them, and every now and again you'll see a car with one of those leafs on it that says, "Hey, New Zealand" or "Kiwi Heritage" or something, and then I wonder, am I, as somebody with no Indigenous blood in us from Australian point of view, am I deeply disrespectful if I wear a shirt that has an Aboriginal flag on it?
Yeah, yeah.
Or am I helping to say that it's not only the minority groups who are being screwed who should be saying, stop screwing us?
Yeah, yeah.
And what is the fight? And am I attacking people?
Yeah, but even the Aboriginal flag to me is, when you look at it from a historical point of view, it arrived out of land right issues. Yeah. And to me, it's a unionisation of many nomadic or language groups within Australia that were about having a say about rightfully as first occupants or First Nation people, they have a say about how the land should be used and they have a rights to it. And that's become a monetary right in a lot of ways as well, which is really sad because, I think... yeah, compensation and all that creates divides between different groups.
It's like a virus of thought is spread, and capitalism is that virus of thought, which is there was a relationship system to tree and to each other, and that relationship system existed without mine, yeah. Existed without individual ownership, and existed across a much greater time frame.
Yeah.
And that's being replaced and eroded.
Yeah.
By what's been
I think it rightfully is a contemporary Australian flag that like if I was to, you know, if I was a sportsman and I won a race and a gold medal, I'd probably cop flak for it, but I'd run with the Australian flag and the Aboriginal flag as an acknowledgement of the people that make up, you know. Even flags, like you should,
we could flags, have, yeah.
They're a funny thing, aren't
nationalism,
they?
Nationalism, is it required?
Yeah, there is an Earth flag now.
Oh shit!
Yeah, it's
that's for when we colonize Mars, and then a few generations later, we're at war with each other.
Yeah,
Mars
yeah,
exactly. versus Earth.
Yep, yep. Or if you believe in aliens, we might be united when when we have alien invasion, you know. That's what when you watch Independence Day, it doesn't matter what colour you are, you're an earthling then, you know. So,
but the Americans save the day.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. America always.
Who knows if it's not North Korea who saves the day in the end, or Russia. Maybe to help, like, condense everything, because I think condensing something makes it really easy for someone to talk about later in a different setting around a dinner party. What is your biggest hope for these shows that you're doing and the ways that you're exposing yourself to all of these influences, which were not part of your upbringing, but now you're making a concerted effort to be informed by them and meet those people and form those relationships?
That's really simple, man. I just want to create a conversation with people that might not have had that conversation before. I'm all about making art for people. I am a conceptual artist, and I'm very clear that the work I make will have that framework, but I'm not interested in just that work being in a loop with the Institute. One of the biggest achievements of my last exhibition was that the gallery did an acknowledgement to the Whadjuk Noongar people. I had Business News come and do a little bit of a story on it because they sort of really found it interesting, the kind of business culture I built around the art, because obviously I worked with different business sectors. Some of them tradesmen. It was the first ever show they went to, and there was a lot of conversation, and that's all you can ask for. If people are at least being aware of maybe different trajectories, then we can move on. It's when people only know one side.
It traps them as well.
Yeah.
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 Wow. So many more sides that I need to find out about.
Oh, we all do. I haven't found all the sides, and I'm very aware that I have an agenda and opinion, but I'm always looking to be challenged.
And I think the real power behind performance or art discussions that are instigated by mediums outside of words is that it facilitates an experience before a... an ear beating or something we were talking about before. It's like, come and have this experience, and hopefully it moves you to a place where you want to know more, or you realize that you know something that, and you can teach me, and then I know more about the thing that I'm doing.
It's also how to regulate that so that it's not this space that opens up for a moment, how you sustain that. That's what I think the arts really needs to start to have a discussion about, is about sustaining, like, you create socially engaged art and all the community have the celebration around and everyone's like feels a difference and change, but how sustained is that for the rest of the their lives, you know? Like, and I suppose that's a very hard thing to put on someone who's, you know, making work. But I feel there's a lot of commonality between a lot of artists, and even you know, looking at art movements at the moment, there's a lot of people talking about cultural identity. And I think if we were able to regulate that and all come together and go, well, how are we all going to say, we're all saying the same kind of thing, but with our slight difference because where we're coming from, how could we create maybe education around this? Or could all these artists be going and doing regular free talks at schools? And that way we're really making change. I think sometimes in the arts we kind of think, we all clap ourselves on the backs and think we're doing this, we're incredibly insightful and we're so aware, but we're really only talking to our peers a lot of the time, you know. Socially engaged work is about social engagement, and it's not just social engagement within the galleries, it's about really regulating that across all sectors. And I really encourage artists to work with non-artists a lot of the time, because I think that's, if you're really creating art that's socially engaged, like working with different sectors, is that's how the world operates, you know. We're made up of many different institutes or thinking or philosophies, and the more we sort of are feeding into that, the better it is, you know.
How do you work out what other sectors you need to engage, or and then how do you go and engage them? How do you knock on their door and say, this is what I do and this is what I think I need from you? And
well, I think a lot of my, I kind of laugh about it, because I sort of say there's this weird thing, is that what I represent is white privilege, and I am. It's like I'm in the world, I am a very like in Australia, I'm a very common person. Like, I'm white, I'm a bloke, and I suppose that's why with industry I kind of represent that. Like, I'm not considered a weird arty, I'm a bloke that makes art. Like, there's which is interesting into your project. And a lot of the time when I engage, like, it's really organic. Like, I don't really force or I just have conversations, and people that go, this is kind of interesting, I want to be a part of this, though I might approach them when I feel there's a space that's opened up. I don't really ever come and go, look, I want you to do this, are you happy? It's very casual. And I don't know.
Where do you meet these kind of people? Because I know, like what you're saying before, quite often you're just chatting with your peers.
Yeah.
So it's like it needs to be a concerted effort at some point.
Yeah, well, when I was in Tom Price, there was a guy called Gary Parker. He worked for one of the Indigenous corporations up there, and we started making art together, and he's pretty connected to culture. I think he had we kind of got together because of his daughter. I was helping her do art, and she's like, oh, this guy's, I'm really enjoying working with him. And he came to a talk I did, and I suppose he was a painter and carver, and then he saw a really diverse practice, and I think it made him think. And I think he's quite fascinated in public art, because there wasn't any real public art that talked about Indigenous culture in the Pilbara. And I sort of talked to him about processes of moulding and casting in metals, and I think he found it really fascinating. I was using material that was like ore and also ochre, and the different, what that material spoke of on a much larger scale. That's how that came about for his daughter, and just being there. You know, when I started working with these engineers, I had done some public art with their next door neighbour. He'd done some cutting, and I just was like, told him I needed to do some stuff with motors, and he goes, oh, my neighbours do that. And I showed him my idea, and it caught their imagination, and they wanted to be involved. It was as simple as that. I think if you don't ask, you don't get. And a lot of the time it's people ask, whereas I sort of, here's an offer. Do you know what I mean? Do you want to do it? Or, when I want to do a collaboration, collaboration isn't about working with someone, and it's when it's really a true collaboration, it's about shaping something together and having that ebb and flow between each other. So When we created this engineered kinetic artwork, I really felt it was a great representation of an engineering practice and an art practice. And even we left all the gears and motors exposed so you could really physically see that. There was a beauty in what they did as well. And the front of it was the choreographic kinetic movement, which was the art. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. How do I approach it? You just put yourself in a space where opportunity can, you can have that exposure or that conversation can happen, I suppose. I wouldn't have been able to have done my mind exhibition if I hadn't actually physically lived in Tom Price, and I lived with a family, and I didn't kind of want to make the work. I never set out to make work about mining because there was so much being said about it. It just, I was just there and I couldn't help but respond to it, you know. It became my world for 3 months. And then I realised it had been a big part of my world for 4 years, just working up and down, you know.
I'm pretty interested in that there was a time before something and there'll be a time after something, and there was a time before Karratha and Pilbara and Kimberley's, and before they had all those names, and before those names were synonymous with mining.
Yeah.
And there'll be a time after.
Yeah.
When those places are not synonymous with mining anymore, and what people will talk about those places.
Yeah.
And what matriarchy hopefully might reign supreme, or what family structures might happen. And
yeah.
Yeah, just remembering that we're at a very specific time.
Yes. Yeah.
And it'll all change. And hopefully part of what we do means that change is something that's been considered rather than accidental towards like the ultimate conquering of everything that is not man.
Yeah. 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 No, it's animism is something the whole world really needs to think about. And it was pretty interesting, like, innovation comes out of necessity. And I think the idea of being a human being, we've actually kind of become bigger than our environment. You know, we're now considering mining in outer space, and NASA are actually funding that at the moment. And it's kind of, there's this sort of about being, I suppose we need to be innovative and keep looking to the future, but I think sometimes we need to look at the past and going, is all this technology, all of this innovative thinking really getting us further away of what the idea of being a human being and connecting with each other is.
Yeah. The old can we or should we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I would like to change the vernacular around solar panels and renewable energy and just change the word to mining. We're mining the sun.
Yeah.
Mining the solar radiation that hits the Earth's surface. Go and make $1 billion on it, sell it to me. I'm happy for that.
Yeah. I think that's the problem in Australia. We have a very short-term economic plan. We've seen that with the mining. With resources, we could have actually had a higher tax for sovereign companies and but like Norway and Sweden have done. But you know, like, it's interesting you bring that up, because Sweden apparently have a program now that's like, they reckon 99% of all household goods are recycled, and they've got to a point where they can actually take on other neighbouring countries recycling, and they've as an economically viable business for their economy. You know, we're so close to, for example, for WA, we're so close to Southeast Asia. And I mean, when I went to Cambodia recently, I was just blown away with how much petrol is used, and everything runs off petrol generators. And I was like, you know, if you could make electricity, you know, electrical tuk-tuks, and they were cheaper in cost and also better for the environment than these fossil fuel operated tuk-tuks, then it would be a big difference. And I think Australia should really be looking at renewable energy as a very viable,
very profitable,
and ethical as well. You know, I think I think there's a bottom dollar that is the Australian way at the moment, and it all comes back to dollars. And I think other countries have Sweden and stuff have actually looked at happiness and how that's measured. It's not all about dollars.
Maybe that's a good wrap up.
Yeah, no, thanks, mate.
Thank you very much.